Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much in the way you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you so much for your disclaimer there and your rambling on. I appreciate you, sir. The tonight's call is going to be a little bit different. As I shared with those of you on the call last night, John has, he was supposed to be the speaker tonight, his wife has a surgery scheduled for this evening, and he's at the hospital with her. So I will be working this out with you tonight. We have with us as well Raven. And perhaps we can encourage her to join in a little bit later when we get through this overview that I want to give. And you know, Kent here is here. Michael from Las Vegas. A lot of people here that have one degree or another of knowledge in this law. And so just would encourage you to participate. I want to once again give you what I refer to as the 40,000-foot view. And that is so that everyone on the call understands what it means to have a team in place to support you, and that's critical. First, the team is divided into two groups. I've got first string and second string. First string and second string is not so much the difference in their educational level, although that is certainly part of the case, but it's also our replacements. The idea, I have what's called a 100-year plan. I fully intend, long after I've turned to dust, and John and everybody else has turned to dust, that these people that are on the second string will be brought into first string. In fact, we hope to bring them in before that time takes, just to enlarge the first string's ability to, you know, cover more people and to assist in the training and teaching of more people. So that's one thing. The second thing is that we have all our bases covered, as far as I can understand. We have one point with litigation that's led by John. Asset protections led by Bernie. Correcting your status is led by GW. And we have a relatively new information provider brought on board, Mr. Slevin, that shares with you how to utilize a particular unique LLC to operate through. We, in addition to that, I'm also interviewing someone that will assist John or actually break out on their own or our broker would break out on their own, another information provider that would deal with land being held in allodial title. So that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that we already have team members in place for taking care of any kind of accounting or bookkeeping purposes. They're either people on that particular sub-team are either CPAs or they're accountants with experience behind them to do what they need to do. We have in place the software It's not manned yet, but we will be moving forward towards putting together our own call center so that you'll be calling in on another number and then directing, depending on what your needs are. Instead of calling me, you'll be going to a call center, and they will then direct the call. So whether it's IRS or land or personal assets or your flesh and blood, it's all covered under this team umbrella. So I think that's a great thing. We are looking to expand the team as well. I'm constantly looking for information providers to cultivate, not necessarily in new realms, but to support the existing foundation that we're building upon now. Some of the students that have come aboard, hiring their teachers like John or Bernie, et cetera, they have a strong foundation in the law as far as due process is concerned, American jurisprudence. And actually, I've already reached out to two different students for coming aboard. So we're growing. We're a focused and organized team with a 100-year plan to cover everything. I'd like to also see that sometime in the future, as we meet other entities, other groups out there that doing similar things, to join and network with them for the overall purpose of the umbrella that all of us operate under, which is AmericansRestoringAmerica.com. So those are the kind of the 30,000-foot view I wanted to share with you. Let's open it up for questions. Press star 2 on your keypad if you'd like to talk about anything particular. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, look to the center right of your monitor, and you'll see a place where you'll see a rectangle, silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side to the center right of your monitor. Left-click into that and type away your comment or your question. I'll be happy to give voice to that. So our first person popping up here is Guy from the Big Apple, as they like to say. Hello, Guy.
Hello. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
I'm very well. I'm very excited. I'm getting closer and closer to my dream to correcting my status.
Wonderful.
I can't wait.
How long do you think before you get started on that?
I'm going to say, at best, 2 more weeks. So it's good. Two more weeks.
Right after the big day, huh?
Yeah, right. Well, I'm a little over halfway there as of today. And good. And I'm very proud of myself.
Excellent.
It's dedicated.
You said you had a question.
Very, very important. Yes, I have two, actually. One, could you please explain to me and to the audience the allodial title, and how you spell that?
Sure.
Actually.
All right. So let's talk about holding land in allodium. First thing is, slaves cannot own land. They're property themselves. And if you look up the definitions of United States, when it talks about United States citizens, you are property and franchises of the United States. So there's no way that you can own anything in allodium. And if you notice, everything that you consider that you own is, you actually have a certificate of title, but not title to.
Right.
Whether it's your automobile, that when you purchased it, you literally gave it away to the state as property, and then you have permission to use that, and you pay them, you know, a registration fee, and you have to renew that and re-up it, et cetera. So the first step in getting your land held into allodium is to correct your status. Then the second step is working with the Bureau of Land Management, researching the title, if you would. From when you purchased it all the way back to when it came into existence. And land comes into existence typically by way of a land grant from whoever owned whatever monarchy owned the land at that time. Here in Florida, it was Spain. So you have the Spanish land grants that were here in Florida, but you have English land grants that are in other parts of the country and even in parts of Florida as well. When, say, Britain took over part of Florida, and then Spain had it and went back and a couple of times. Most people don't know it. The oldest city in the nation is not in the Northeast. It's right here in St. Augustine, Florida. And it came into existence, what, 1565, I believe, was the year. Long before 1620, when Plymouth Rock was established. So there's some interesting things there. Anyways, the Bureau of Land Management pretty much covers all of the different land grants around the country, except those within the New England states. I see that Jennifer Sue's on the line here. She's done some terrific research in that with regards to the land patents and who owned what, when, and where, and all those good things, land patent maps. And they're not really controlled and organized through the Bureau of Land Management. They're in nooks and crannies all over the place, county courthouses and things like that. Maybe Jennifer Sue will expand upon it. But the bottom line is at present, all land in the United States is considered to be held by the United States. And just as right. all people in the United States are considered to right. be property of the United States. So there are challenges that are put in place, evidence that has to be established, and it's not a simple process. It's not a short process. It's one that drags out a little bit, and it will be challenged. But the end result is that you'll own the land in Elodium, and there will be no taxes on it. You will not be told how you can build a piece on your property. However, if you want any services from the local government, you'll have to contract separately with the fire department or contract separately with the police department and so forth to provide your services. So that's basically it in a nutshell.
Okay. Well, so when the land purchase is made by a Louisiana purchase of Alaska, by that, like, null and void, then we're someone back.
You're breaking up, Guy. We're hearing your words kind of staccato on your connection. I heard something about the Louisiana purchase.
Yeah, are we going back that far with our?
Oh yeah, sure. I had a home here in Florida that was land granted to a man named Domingo Reyes, a Spaniard, and I traced my land all the way back. On the title, all the way back to when Domingo Reyes received that land grant from the King of Spain. Unfortunately, at that time that I was doing this, which is almost 30 years ago, I had no understanding then about the personam status, the status of citizenship, being an American national. Never heard of it then. So I was never able to perfect a allodial title on my land because I was not in that jurisdiction to be able to do it.
Right. Okay, I understand. Well, the question that remains with the allodial title of the year is ultimately the title then being held in escrow. So is there a difference between real estate and property as we understand it?
The word real, as in real estate, does not mean bona fide. It's actually backed on from the word meaning royal estate, instead of real estate. It's royal estate. And it was all part of the king's land. So that's where the word real is, and then estate is just like that, an estate.
Right.
So it was land belonging to the king or the monarchy, and that's where that came from. Now, you said talking about property?
Yes, sir.
Property. Property can be held privately or publicly, et cetera. That's really a question for one of the information providers. But I know that it's a sensitive word in law and has to be used properly.
Okay. All right. Well, the next question was you kind of touched on it a little bit in your opening statement about you're looking to expand and being so close to New York or operating business there. I would like to possibly be able to start telling individuals about this opportunity.
Oh, sure.
I'm not yet there as far as strong as a candidate. I my knowledge in the whole system right now is still premature.
One other thing that I wanted to cover on your land that's held in the Lodial title, a title company can help you to a large degree by hiring them, paying them to provide what's called an abstract of title. And the abstract of title will take that that lineage in law, follow the chain of custody, if you would, or chain of evidence of ownership from today all the way back to when it was held by different monarchies.
Uh-huh. So what happens when you get, you find the, like, you go all the way back to first ownership of?
Well, then there's public publications that you have to exert with your claim of right to the land by virtue of the abstract of title. It's not a simple process. I know that I've heard some people say it's simple, but it's not really. But it'll be done for you when you're ready. Okay?
Okay. All right. Yes, sir. Thank you very much for your.
Well, thank you so much for chiming in, Guy. We appreciate you. Miss Jennifer Sue, how are you?
Oh, good.
Wakey.
I was going to ask about now that I've corrected my status. I would like to send a letter to the income tax section of the IRS. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, do you have a specific letter that I can use, or should I just make one up and get it approved, or what?
Well, I tell you, I would encourage you to make one up on your own and then get it in front of John so that John can sit there work with you on it. John is in the process and hope to have it done by April 15th. There's other issues on the burner, other students on the front burner that have to be tended to, but the goal is to have a letter so that when people are filing on that funny day, that this letter will go along with their affidavit and maybe a photocopy of their passport and pass card. And basically, the letter is going to say something to the effect of, I'm not really clear if I'm supposed to file in that I'm no longer a United States citizen. Well, the other thing, too, that we stumbled across just a few weeks back, 3 weeks back ago, was when one of the students just on their own went to, without talking to anybody, they just went and updated their voting registration in their local county. And they received a letter back that says that you're not eligible to vote because you're not a United States citizen after having corrected their status. So we're collecting evidence where we can. There's some people that are renewing their driver's license, and we're going to try a similar process. To see if we can get the licensing bureau to come back with some sort of a comment as to whether or not it's needed or required.
Now, will the W-8 then be part of the paperwork as well that you send to the tax IRS in April?
Well, the language, no, because the language, the W-8 vent is for an employer when you want to be a worker instead of an employee. And, you get them to withdraw, or deduct anything from your pay, your compensation. Of course, as we know historically, the, people that you're working with or for are scared beyond the death with, to the IRS. And when they seek, counsel from their accountants or their CPAs, these people were trained by a curriculum that I personally think was developed originally by the IRS so that most of the money would be made as possible in collecting as much taxes as possible. So it's not something that would typically easily be moved forward, but that's its purpose and that's its intent from the IRS to an employer. Yet, you know, they run from it.
I thought GW said he keeps his W-8 Ben and his affidavit in his car together.
He does. He does. And as I do mine. The difference, the W-8 Ben, though, is specifically, uniquely, originally crafted by the IRS to tell an employer not to deduct money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's that part.
All right. Well, I'll see if I can put something together and send it off to you.
I'm always interested in seeing what you develop. I love the way you take the bull by the horns and you just charge in. That's really great.
I want to get everything done.
Right.
I want to get Chase's credit card done too.
Exactly. All right. Anything else,
right,
Jennifer? Well, thank you. All right, Brent, go ahead.
I'll just say it took 2.5 years for me to get my chain of title together.
It took that long?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to make any comment before we bring Brent up? Do you want to make Brent up? You want to make any comment about how the New York or Pennsylvania, that area up there, is so different with regards to chasing down the abstract of title?
I just hired different people for different things, and I looked online. I just looked everywhere, asked a million questions from every source I could. Some people were helpful and said, you've got to go here or there, and then they would say, well, we don't have that, but this department does over here. So, you know, I mean, all the stuff that we got was from all over the place. They don't keep everything to one place.
All right. Excellent. Unlike down here in Florida, I just contacted BLM. I think it was up in Bureau of Land Management. I should say it out because people think something else about it. But I think the one I contacted was in Virginia that handled the Southeast United States. What was the last thing I wanted to mention? The work that Mr. Slevin does with regards to this unique LLC is the direction that we're pursuing in that it is more recognized by employers who are accustomed to dealing with LLCs. For instance, if an employer has a cleaning company that comes in, you know, every night to empty garbage packs and vacuum the floor and things like that, they're sending out a check for cleaning services to an LLC, and that is so many other things. If they're advertising and the advertiser is an LLC, they're sending checks out, you know, to pay for whatever services they hire. So it's not like they're not accustomed to it, and so that's the direction that we're looking more to assist people in segregating themselves from an employee status. Just to share. Next is Brent. Go ahead, Brent. What's up on your end?
Hey, good evening. Thank you, Jennifer, for bringing up those issues, the question. That is also really high up on my list of things to do is to head the IRS off at the pass. I did my affidavit before April 15th, 2021, and I could not sign a 1040 form, so I have not filed 2021 taxes. And I'm very interested in, keeping the dogs at bay, so to speak, but also in recovering the withholdings that I had for that year and years prior. So I'm extremely interested in any letter that might get drafted.
Sure. I don't think there'll be any issue going back 3 years because that's just normal operating procedures for the IRS. You've got 3 years to adjust and amend. But what we're looking for, I'm looking for, is to go back, like the affidavit says, this has been from the point of the beginning, meaning ab initio, and you need to correct your records, nunc pro tunc, which means you need to correct your records to the point of the beginning. And so if that's the case, then I would think that a proper court challenge would be, I want everything you took from me back, plus the interest on it. I think that's what we want to look at.
Yeah, well, I'd be happy to get 3 years to start with. The main thing is to, just get it established so I don't have to sweat about it. I don't want to be sweating about it anymore.
Well, as you well know, Brent, there's people on the front burner that have to be taken care of right now. And
absolutely. I'm not asking you for that right now. Not what I'm saying at all.
Sure.
I'm applauding Jennifer for taking the bull by the horns, as you put it, and also maybe a cooperative effort among people like her and me, we can actually come up with something that might be acceptable.
Sure. Absolutely. Anything else, Brent?
Yeah. I was just commenting on that because she brought that up. My question had to do with the let's see, I was thinking about the property situation and I think I had asked this question before regarding property that has a mortgage on it and it can still be put into a trust.
Correct. Into a charitable religious trust, so long as the person that owes the debt is a beneficiary. In other words, the beneficiaries can't change.
Okay. And then as far as the allodial title, that doesn't apply until the mortgage is paid off.
Well, there's a lien on it, but now one of the things that I'd like to do with someone is to they would engage the team for a preemptive home foreclosure service, meaning that they would get the securitization audit through one of our information providers that we have, that they would do what's called a qualified written request, which the team would provide. And once the qualified written request is done, that's done first, and the securitization audit is done, then the homeowner's current.
Pardon me.
The homeowner's current. Then the homeowner would write the purported lender and say, "I have evidence here that you are not the owner and holder of the note that I signed 8 years ago, 18 years ago, whatever it is. And I would like to have the opportunity to review that note." See, no litigation yet. So you're asking to cure the question. You keep on making your payments. You have totally clean hands. The best place to always operate in litigation is with clean hands. And ask to have it seen. Once, if you can get, you do this questioning, this request for 3 months, 90 days, and every 30 days, you'd be following up with your request to review the original wet sign note. So far, we've seen in the past the purported lender totally ignores you, Then another thing is that you'd make an offer to pay off. We have people that will, that, you know, for a fee, will sit there and pay off the note, provide the cash to pay off a note. And, again, that's done through a chain of evidence that, you know, the offer's made, et cetera. And, again, it's ignored. So far they've been ignored. Then you, the homeowner, sue XYZ Bank for quiet title. And now when you go in, you have all this evidence of where you've, and you're still current when you sue them. You don't stop paying them. And you show them, you show the court where you've offered to, you know, request to see because of the securitization audit. And nothing was forthcoming, crickets. You showed them where you made an offer to pay off the note, pay off the mortgage, but you just have to review this, and you want to have a forensic auditor review the document for its authentication. And at that point in time, you know, where are they going to go, and what's the judge going to do? There's nothing that they can do but give you quiet title. So that's the game plan on that. That's the strategy on that.
Well, I would be a candidate for that. I'm game for that. We can talk, you know, privately if you'd like.
Sure. Yeah. We'll start with that. You'll hire the team separately for that, as you are aware with the, you know, hiring the team brings in. And we'll cover it all by itself. Talk to me tomorrow if you like.
Okay. Again.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Brent. Appreciate you. Next is Kent. I love this guy. He's got great questions. Always has great questions.
Good evening, Michael.
Good evening, Kent. How are you?
Okay. And yourself?
Yeah, very well. Thank you. Incidentally, ladies and gentlemen, kudos to Kent. He was the gentleman that introduced me to Mr. Slevin, who is our Wednesday night anchor regarding the LLCs. So it pays to know people.
Okay. Thank you. Three things. I was told that presently the title insurance is basically just insuring the improvements on the land, and they really don't have the ability to insure the land at all. Have you found this to be the case, or do you think that this information may not be correct from what you know?
Well, from what I know is they claim that they'll have title insurance guarantees that the purported lender is the owner and holder of the note. And it's really kind of a scam if you think about it, in the sense that if the purported lender is not required by the court and not compelled by the court to produce the note, they can just go ahead and talk about make believe all they want.
Mm-hmm.
So
Go ahead.
No, I'm just going to be repeating myself what I said earlier to Brent. The idea is to start with QWR, qualified written request. Start with a qualified written request. At the same time, you're doing a background on the securitization audit of the actual note by the public record. And then once those things are put in place, then you move forward with a request to review the wet ink note in their office. And after 90 days, if they're not doing that, then turn around and go to the process where you're offering to pay off the note, and, you know, with proof of funding to pay off the note. And all it requires is that you must have the wet ink signature of the note, an affidavit signed under, of course, that means penalty and perjury, signed under penalty and perjury that by the custodian of records when they received the note at the closing, from the closing table, or if they bought the note from somebody else when they received that in their possession. And You also want to have, you cannot separate a note from the mortgage or the note from the deed of trust. They do it all the time, but the law says you can't separate them. You also want to see the original of that, not a copy. And again, chain of custody by the custodian of records. And if you really want to become anal about it, you can require the financial officer of the lending institution of the day that the loan was made to provide what's, if I hadn't thought about it, I'd said it. Anyways, every single day at 2 o'clock, banks do a P&L. And you want to see that that P&L. It's got a specific name for it, a specific word. I just happen to don't remember it at the moment. Call report. There we go. You want a certified copy of that day's call report to prove that the amount of money that was lent was available to the bank to loan that money. And, of course, they have to show that against all the loans that were made that day. You know, it's a P&L statement, so it's all going to be there. Good luck in getting it, but it's something that you should be entitled to prove up the claim. Put all those things together, then go for quiet title. It's a similar procedure that you're doing in an actual home foreclosure. The difference being is that you're not coming in with clean hands until you get to the place where you're offering to pay off the note. Then you have clean hands. But up until that point, you're looked upon by the courts as somebody that is just thrashing about trying to save their home because they can't afford to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
How it's looked. So clean hands always works best.
Well, I guess what you're talking about with the call report is something I heard about back in the late 80s or 90s when a gentleman was working on a mortgage with a very small bank in New Jersey. And apparently what he ended up doing was subpoenaing their information regarding how many Federal Reserve notes they had in their vault that day. And he ultimately, from what I understand, he ultimately prevailed. He was given a hard time, but he did ultimately prevail. I don't think the mortgage was for that much money at that time, and not a lot was made of it. He did speak about it a little bit before he passed away, and that was pretty much it. We didn't hear any more. So I would imagine that sounds very similar to what you're saying is in asking for the call report, although I never heard that terminology used.
That man's name wasn't by chance Thomas Schaff, was it?
No, it was not.
Okay. Thomas Schaff was where I learned all this from back in the 90s. He's a certified public accountant. I don't even know if he's still alive today, but he proves it's all done by the forensic auditing of the loan.
Mm-hmm.
And he can prove nobody actually loaned any money. The promissory note that you signed to pay for the mortgage for the loan is monetized, and they just deposit that promissory note into a checking account. So they're paid. Anyways, that's a long, drawn story. I don't think anybody on this call is interested in that at the moment.
All right,
anything else,
Dan? Yes, back to the title insurance. So what would it be, and I don't ask this question maliciously because this could work for someone or against them, why wouldn't someone or couldn't someone who was going, who had corrected their status and had some property that was, in a subdivision or part of a land grant or something, a portion thereof, if in fact a title insurance company cannot really insure the land and only the improvements, then what would be there to stop someone from, including if you were trying to do this and it was disrupting the government, what would be to stop anyone, including the government, from coming in and trying to claim the entire patent on that whole original tract, claiming that only the improvements are insured and put in the chain of title, but not really the land?
Well, again, the word that keeps coming up in my mind is annotated, but it's not annotated. It's Abstract. Yeah, the abstract. The abstract of title shows who is the proper and lawful owner of the land. And it's never the United States within its confined constitutional rights. First thing, any litigation against someone who has corrected their status is historically, it's always done, litigation is always done in an Article I court. Article I. Because those are courts for the United States. Article III courts are for the several states, for the Union state citizens. So any charge against you, any charge, you know, even murder, and you've got the smoking gun in your hand or the bloody knife in your hand when they walked in on you, and they got CCTVs showing you that you did it. They still properly have to do this through an Article III court for someone who has corrected their status. Now, will they steamroll over it? Well, yeah, they're tyrants. So there's other issues that have to be dealt with. That's why I love to watch, and really I wish everyone could listen to these calls that I have the blessing to be auditing, where John is crafting a strategy to deal with these tyrants. By, you know, ever being so nice, but, you know, continually blocking and closing doors on them to where they have no place to go but to not get involved with the matter. So that's what we're doing there. That's what John's doing.
Yep. Well, from my knowledge of the business, I would think that the way title insurance work is done today, that it would be open to attack, because it's also my understanding that what most people are paying for title insurance is nowhere near the comprehensive report and goes back nowhere near as far as they used to do with title insurance, but they're primarily relying on what the other party set up to the last alleged quote-unquote transfer of title, and then they're just bringing it forward to the present time. So now, in researching this and attacking it, there could be multiple parties if it was not the same title insurance company all of the time. I mean, it seems to me that there's a lot of unanswered questions yet about this. And I'm not saying that those unanswered questions should stop anybody. Some of those unanswered questions may make it easier to move this whole operation forward.
Right. I have spoken personally to 7 or 8 different title companies in the venue that I sojourn, and the initial contact people didn't even know what the term abstract of title was. And I had to, I'm serious, I had to say, is there someone here who is a principal, you know, the owner of this title company? Well, yeah, there's so-and-so. You have to have an appointment to see them. And I said, really, just for one question? And, you know, I'd get my way schmoozed in and then say, yes, oh, yeah, we know about the abstract of title. I used to do that 20 years ago, 40 years ago, but not anymore. We don't have to do them anymore. We just do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay,
I'll tell you what.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Tell you what, come a lawsuit, abstract title is the highest evidence that you can have directly underneath a lodium.
Mm-hmm.
Takes an abstract of title to get to the lodium.
All righty. The second topic is, you were talking before with Brent about the recovery going back beyond 3 years. So for some of us who are older, this could go back 50, 60 years easily.
Sure. I was 14 when I first started working outside the family.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're in the same category.
So
if we were to go back that far, way beyond the 3 years that the IRS, you know, generally deals with, let's put it that way, we would be looking at a great amount of time. Now, would we then be going into territory, do you think, that Bernie talks about when he talks about FICA and the fact that he stopped doing what he was doing because people then couldn't make a living because they couldn't live totally independent of the system, and that we would actually cut off that also by going back to get refunds back to day one. Do you think that would then go back to what Bernie is talking about that he actually did in the 90s, or do you still see a separation point here between the income taxes and the FICA?
I think that a discussion within the four corners of a paper has to be made with a potential student to where they understand all the downside to what they're proposing to do. And I understand perfectly what Bernie was talking about. I've watched others clean the slate, only to be now in a position where they couldn't financially afford to continue to provide for their family in the way that the family would like to be provided for. Outside the system, it's a very scary place. Myself, I wouldn't be anywhere else. I'd rather be a salesman working on 10% plus or more commission than I would be working for someone. You know, and if I could get more percentages and say, you don't even have to give me a draw, just let me run with it. That's just my nature. But that's very rare to find in most people. Most people want the safety and security of, you know, a JOB and things like that. So, if somebody said to me, look, I want completely out, and so forth, my first question to them is, I'm going to ask you some questions that are deeply personal to you, none of my business, but I'm not going to assist you or direct you unless I know and understand these questions that I'm going to ask you, simply because I don't want to be responsible for dropping you into a snake pit. Simple as that. And my question is going to be, how are you going to afford this? Not talking about paying the information providers. How are you going to afford this once it's cleared, once you're done, once you're totally out of the system? How are you going to afford to live? Do you have an income stream coming in or streams coming in? How many streams do you got to have coming in? You need more than one. You need more than three. I'm not even comfortable with five or six. You need income streams. How many do you have? And then the answer comes back, what's an income stream? So, you know, there's just some people that I would be saying no to, just like Bernie is saying no to. But we're also dealing with a large number of people who happen to believe, as I do, that there is going to be at least one country that will be resetting the value of their currency to a much higher amount than what we've acquired that currency for. And they will be able to live the rest of their life protected that with that currency exchanged into a charitable religious trust controlled by a corporation soul, and never have to worry about getting, quote, income, end quote, in their lives. So they can extricate themselves and not be concerned with what they may have to do in order to survive in the future, because their future and their children's future and their grandchildren's future is already protected.
Well, I asked this question from, you know, and I'm sure you realize this, but for everybody's benefit, from a larger scope or a larger point of view, because I don't think that we should at some point in time think like with a revaluation or something else, or with people that, you know, have resources from other avenues or other streams of income, we shouldn't limit ourselves to thinking that maybe those are the only people we could assist to get this job done, because we need to, this has to be presented to the average man out there. And if they like it, that's fine. And if they agree with it, that's fine. And if they don't, that's okay. Also, they can continue on the way they're going. But I still think that it has to reach a larger audience. So, and in reaching that larger audience, we have to give them all the facts so that they don't later get stuck and say, oh boy, I put myself in a really bad place, you know, kind of like some of us did when we, you know, stopped paying property taxes or we stopped paying a mortgage or something before we really had everything in order. You know, certainly
exactly.
What we were doing, we thought was correct, and many of us have been in that position. You know, I can speak for myself, and, you know, we now realize that, you know, hey, we just didn't do this the right way. But
right.
We can prevent other people from going there. And the third topic that I wanted to bring up, if you care to speak about it, you were talking about the 40,000-foot view, and in the past you've alluded to other things that you want to do. And many of the people, I'm sure, on this call from what's said before, although not discussed at length because it hasn't been the call to do that or the type of call to do that, you've talked about some health issues, and many of us are interested in that. Where do you see your 100-year plan, or what is in your 100-year plan, if you choose to discuss it, regarding that the health issues?
Well, before we jump into that, let me just say that additionally that one of our information providers, GW, is intimately involved in with another group out of Texas that have a bank charter that was established prior to 1933, and that will be exploited to its nth degree. And we've been blessed. When I say we, I'm talking about all the information providers and the students and the membership at Americans Restoring America. We've been included in the first, you know, wave, well, when this is finally, you know, opened up and made available. So we have ground floor access to that, and where that can go is anywhere. It can go anywhere because it's something that's outside of the system by its very creation date. With regards to health, every information provider I have that is on the team are people who are very health conscious and knowledgeable in the natural ways of getting things done. For instance, just as a little example, I was mandated to have Eliquis, which is like a $500 a month prescription just for that because I had 3 heart attacks in one day, and they said I had to have it. My wife looked at that and said, "Well, what's the Eliquis doing?" And well, it thins your blood out, and it's kind of like what something else did that was rat poison before the Eliquis. And she goes, "Well, why aren't you just taking cayenne peppers and things like that, and spicing up your food? That'll do the same thing." And the doctor looks at her like she's crazy and then brings a nutritionist in to tell her what she needs to do for my diet and so forth. And she's saying, "You want to give that man blah, 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 that's loaded with sugar. Why are you doing that? That's going to hit his immune system." Just tore into him. Point being is that we have many people who are already predicated to go in that direction. It's going to take funding. If you go to AmericansRestoringAmerica.com, you click on the tab that says humanitarian, click on that. You're going to see where I want to create a village, 600 acres, 1,000 acres in every county, starting with my county. And some counties like Miami-Dade, I might have 3 or 4 of these plots where you have a self-sustaining village. It'll be its own corporation soul. We'll be moving them into land held in allodium by the corporation soul. And each place will have its own wellness center. And the wellness center will be something that can be available to the public, but they must become members of that corporation soul. So that the corporation soul can work outside of the system, if you would. And that's definitely where we're going to go. I think that, was it Ayurveda, the Indian medicine? I think that, Ayurveda, yeah, Chinese medicine. Western medicine is terrific if you've been shot, if you're in an automobile accident, you've gone through the windshield, that's great. The triage is fantastic, but when you're trying to become healthy and maintain your health, we lose it over here, and everything is great in the Indian, Chinese cultures. Their healing programs. So that's where we'll be going and focusing on.
Well, every culture in the world really has some method behind them of natural medicine.
Right.
I mean, that's just the history of the world. I think that Western medicine is good for one more thing. Well, you were talking about triage, so this kind of relates to it. I think some of the diagnostic methods they have, if they're basically non-invasive, I think they are good for determining a baseline in addition to them being good for trauma. But beyond that, as it relates to everyday healthy living, you know, they just don't have it. I just had a discussion this week with a doctor regarding what you're talking about, the value of Eliquis and how the value of that differs from 81 milligrams of baby aspirin and how that differs from natokinase and other natural remedies and how they all work on a different factor in the blood, et cetera. So I think these are all things, you know, we don't want to criticize Western medicine in total because there are some good things that it does, but we certainly need to change the way we operate in this country as far as natural methods. So that's what I was interested in hearing from you as to where you were going with that.
Right. And the fact that the medical society has been so overcome and overwhelmed and supplanted by pharmaceuticals, which is nothing but taking the natural remedies, finding the employable components of that natural medicine, then distilling it and then selling it for a ridiculous price. That's hurt us an awful lot. So,
okay. But thank you for your comments. I appreciate your candidness and all the work you do. Thank you.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you. Appreciate you being there. Next is Guy and then Jennifer, and then we're going to say goodnight. Go ahead, Guy.
Yes, sir. I heard that earlier evening, what was his name, Ken, I believe, he was asking about the driver's license. Now, once I obtained my corrected status, how will my CDLA change?
Well, you've got to remember, let me pull this up real quick if I can find it here. There's a court case that is so important for all of us. Give me one second here. Almost. All right, so we're there. I'll be right above it. Keep going. This is W.W. Cargill Company versus State of Minnesota. It's a 1901 court case. It's found at 180 U.S. 452. And it says, quote, the acceptance of a license in whatever form will not impose upon the licensee an obligation to respect or to comply with any provision of the statute or with the regulations prescribed that are repugnant to the Constitution of the United States, end quote. So your CDL or your regular class driver's license, you know, for whatever, these may be required by the people you work for. And having that requirement in order to be working for these people, that's fine. It doesn't change anything with regards to your having corrected your status. And conversely, and I have yet to see it done, don't know what the outcome would be, but I'm just curious. Probably the only safe way to run it, to do it, would be through a privately owned trucker. Not somebody that works for somebody, but they do their own, you know, booking and hauling. And
right,
that is
right.
that is when they get the blue light special in their side mirrors, they hand them, instead of the CDL and whatever book that they're supposed to show and so forth, they just hand them that State Department card. We've never had it happen yet. We don't have anyone to try that yet. But it'll be the first one. As soon as I interview someone and they go, yeah, I have a CDL and I do my own trucker. I'm all by myself. I'm a lone cowboy out there. I'm saying, hey, would you like to do something for us?
Yeah, right. Well, the reason why I asked, Michael, was a very simple
question. The last thing that we've heard is the reason why I ask. We haven't heard anything after that.
Yes, sir. I apologize. The reason why I ask is because very, very soon I'm looking at leasing a crane from an outfit there in New York doing business. And I know
it won't hurt you at all. It won't hurt you at all. Follow whatever the employer wants you to do. The guy that hires you and get whatever licenses. It does not interfere. It does not void. The having a license doesn't void you having corrected your status in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, that was my question. Thank you.
And likewise, it doesn't interfere with any benefits that you're due from the government, whether it's retirement or.
Well, that was my question. Was kind of two pronged. I have this tax debt that recently, if you may remember. I'm being threatened with by the IRS. I want to get correcting my status before I have to answer to the IRS.
Sure.
Is
the dollar amount in question $50,000 or more?
No, not
good.
Actually,
okay, fine.
Less than $10,000, but
fantastic
that, for that year. There's other years that will be coming up soon.
But they're not here now.
No, correct.
Yeah, were I similarly situated, I would be correcting my status real quick.
Right. Everything else in my life right now is on hold. I just got to get that so much together, get you and your team working on them, what you got to do. I'm at your beck and mercy.
Most excellent. All right. Thank you, Guy.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
All right. Jennifer, take us home.
A couple of things. I've asked multiple title companies over the years about the abstract title. And just the other day, I did the same thing. And they basically said it's impossible in for my deed, and it would cost literally thousands and thousands and thousands of hours and dollars because
45 years ago, I paid to have an abstract done, and it was $600. So
right.
I would imagine $4,000, $5,000 today.
Well, they were saying that not only do they have to look for the deed, but they have to look through everything else to make sure there's no other liens, encumbrances, and all the other things that there could be, back to 1708, basically. And because there's not really all the documents even back that far, that they don't think that they even exist. So you couldn't get a full, whole, abstract your title anymore. So they say, I'm sure someone has one somewhere, but a regular title companies say they can't do it. And my daughter, her deed's back to 1664. Her patent, sorry, is back to 1664. And I don't know, they just don't want to do it. They just said it's too much work.
Oh, well. You got to keep working at it, keep knocking on the doors.
I do. But anyway, another thing I'm interested in, if people are willing, after they get a card, after they get their corrected their status and they get their card in the mail, I'm interested in knowing how many asterisks or stars they have along the top, and whether that person is was born in America, or born overseas, or in the military, or whatever. I'm just interested in seeing if there's any similarities in numbers of asterisks on the cards.
We will be able to profile once we have some numbers. We have like 30, 35 people that have processed this already. We don't have enough yet.
Well, do you know how many asterisks are on each card they have?
No, I haven't asked that question. But I'm saying that I've got the names, I've got the contacts, and it's something that we can do. I'm just not looking to do it today. That's all.
Yeah, I just thought it'd be interesting. That's all. Not that we'd probably even know what it would actually mean, but just for the fun of it, you know.
Sure. All righty. I want to thank everyone for joining. Is there anything else, Jennifer?
No, that's good. Thanks.
I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. I want to remind everyone that tomorrow night is Mr. Slevin. You really should be on that call to listen to what he's bringing to the table with regards to the LLC. The LLC enables people, whether you are an entrepreneur, you own a business, or you're an employee, and you've been working for somebody, this is a tool that you can use to basically pull yourself out of the employee status and to translate into a business owner, if you would, doing business with another business owner by way of your LLC. And the grand scheme of things is that the LLC is $7,500. Two charitable religious trusts are $1,000 apiece. So for $9,500, you have had this entity created that you can operate through. And then sometime in the future, if you ever decide to do what's called a golden horseshoe, this perfectly sets in as the center component to the golden horseshoe. And the money that you spent there is money that you're not spending in the golden horseshoe, so it's less expensive, of course, and it's really the way to go. So I encourage everyone to be on tomorrow night's call with Mr. Slevin. It's going to be very interesting. Until then, I want to thank everybody again for joining us tonight. Until tomorrow night, be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.